You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. I guess we're not too solar-powered today because finally we're having some rain. We had quite a dry summer, and now we're getting some beautiful gray days, which we really enjoy. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My co-host is not with us today. My mother, as our loyal listeners know, my mother is my co-host, Caroline. And we just returned from a family trip to Rome. And so she isn't able to be over here in Fairfield with us today. But we do have a really great show for you, and I'm so excited to have Jennifer Egan on Writers' Voices with us today. Jennifer is the author of 5 previous books of fiction, including A Visit from the Goon Squad, which won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, The Keep, the short story collection Emerald City, Look at Me, which was a National Book Award finalist, and The Invisible Circus. And her latest book, which just came out and is an amazing read, Manhattan Beach. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
So this just got published this week, right?
Yes. It's only been a couple of days.
So, you know, you've been doing this for a while. You've had some great success as a writer. Do you still get the same rush when the book comes out?
You know, yes. I mean, I think I take long enough to write these books that I never really think they're going to be published. I seem to achieve the same state of doubt and disbelief about that every single time. So this time was no exception, and this one I think actually was my hardest book to write for many reasons that we can talk about, and so it feels absolutely surreal that it has come out. I really am still in that state of disbelief.
The publicity about this book, it talks about it as being kind of a departure from some of your previous work. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think, you know, usually with a new book, I tend to try to work against what I have done in the previous book. and in the last few, though, there has been a lot of structural trickiness. I've been very interested in technology, and I think maybe that is what has led me to a lot of fragmentation and sort of formal experimentation, if you will. A lot of narratives that are fractured. And I found, I had the thought of using some of those same techniques with this book, but I found that when I tried to, the material just died. Mm-hmm. It didn't thrive within that sort of structural milieu. I had to employ something very different. And so I was just following my story and telling it the best I could, which is what I always do. It's just that it led me in a slightly different direction that I think, I guess, really harkens back more to my first novel and my story collection, in that the storytelling, although it's still a pretty complicated book and there are many different points of view and 3 major protagonists, there's a more kind of forward throttle to this one than I've used for a while.
Mm. It does sound complicated. That's...
Well, I mean, it's complicated in the sense that it's a, you know, it's about intersecting lives.
Right.
Two men and a woman. I think what made it complicated for me in the writing process is that it involves fairly intricate knowledge of a few different worlds. Certainly the world of gangsters and organized crime, especially on the waterfront in New York. The Brooklyn Navy Yard, where, you know, literally thousands of Allied ships were repaired during World War II. The Merchant Marine, which was responsible for bringing, you know, basically all of the war materiel that was required for the war to the field of battle. And then just New York. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting an important one, deep sea diving.
Oh, wow.
And then the city of New York in all of its, you know, kind of complexity and crowding and sort of war activity during that time. So there were just there are a lot of different worlds that collide in this book.
And of course, you mentioned deep sea diving, and it's not today's deep sea diving. It's what it was like in the 40s, which must be different. There must be improvements in the technology that have.
Yes, for sure. Although interestingly, the equipment that was used in the 40s, which is a suit called the Mark V, which probably anyone would recognize, it has a very archetypal deep sea diver look to it. I think because it was used for so long, basically from the beginning of the 20th century almost into the 60s. It's with the cylindrical copper helmet, and the big bulky suit, the big boots, the three-fingered gloves. That's what was worn. And luckily I was able to talk to many people who actually dived in that suit because it was used for so long. I was even able to be dressed in one myself, although needless to say I did not dive, which was also pretty fascinating.
Oh, I bet. So where did the idea for this story come from?
I tend to start with a time and a place more than a story, well, definitely rather than a story or characters. I was very interested in New York during World War II, and I think in a way that interest probably dates back to 9/11, when the city really felt like a war zone for several months. And I think that led me to think about the last time it had felt that way, obviously outside my lifetime. I think also 9/11 led me to think about the trajectory of American superpower. It felt, you know, that attack felt like some sort of event along that trajectory. And I think we're only now, you know, we're still learning what the repercussions of that are. But I was interested in the origin of American superpower and what it felt like to sense it amassing, you know, as Americans. And that, again, led me back to World War II. So I was really interested in the city at that time. And then I started by just looking at a lot of images, photographs of New York during the war, and what immediately struck me was just the omnipresence of the waterfront. The waterfront was everything. It was the way people transported themselves and everything else into and out of the city. And then the waterfront led me to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which led me to diving, because deep sea diving was actually an important part of ship repair, was and is. You know, surveying and patching and repairing from below is an important part of ship repair. So, you know, one thing led to another, and that was sort of where I got my setting. And then the way I actually come up with the story is by writing a first draft by hand in a fairly automatic and blind way, which I did over a period of a year and a half, filling up about 1,400 pages with handwriting. And then out of that, and the reason I do that is that that's really how I get my best ideas. If I just sit down and think, oh, what should happen? I get nothing that anyone else couldn't have thought of. But creating this kind of mess of spontaneous and instinctive material gives me some more interesting ideas. And then from those, I create an outline and a much more kind of analytical framework and a bucket list of things that need to change and get better. But that initial outpouring is very instinctive.
Okay, so we got to delve into this a little bit more. So you have this place, this setting, and you start writing. At some point, characters come in.
Well, usually right away.
Right away.
I mean, because otherwise, nothing can happen.
Okay, that's true. That's true. So, like, when you started writing Manhattan Beach, was Eddie the first character that came to you?
I think I knew that there was going to be a woman at the center of this. My work has skewed toward the male, I would say. And I think one reason for that is that since I really don't like to write about myself or anything that feels familiar to me, writing from a male point of view is kind of an easy way to differentiate what I'm writing from my own life. So I have a kind of tendency to skew male, and that has given me a strong wish to tell a really, I mean, of course, I ended up with two male protagonists and one female, so you could say that I did the same thing again this time. But I was really interested in writing something that was overtly about female strength. Mm-hmm. And so I had a feeling that this might be the book in which I did that, because the war was just such a fascinating period for women in America. You know, they were called upon to do things they had been told they couldn't do their whole lives. And, you know, and the roots of the women's movement really were laid then, and all kinds of things were fascinating about that period. So I was expecting a female on the premises, and I had a feeling there was going to be a kind of underworld figure that would play an important part in the book. And I think part of the reason for that is that as soon as you start, you know, looking carefully at the waterfront, you immediately bump up against organized crime, immortalized in the movie On the Waterfront, which is really about the corrupt unions that controlled the Irish waterfront on the west side of Manhattan and in New Jersey. But in general, the waterfront was such a conduit for goods that there was a tremendous amount of money to be made there from pilfering and graft and all kinds of other things, and therefore organized crime was very active there. So I the other thing that really interested me about crime, or about gangsters, if you will, at that time, is that they were kind of romantic figures in a way that they aren't now. And I could feel that interest as well. And then as far as Annie's father, Eddie, he was a little bit of a surprise to me, too. I knew, you know, fathers or absent fathers have tended to play a big role in my work. But I think what was surprising about this was that I began with a story about a lot of intimacy between a little girl and her father. And that was kind of unexpected, but a nice thing to experience on the page.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it definitely was. And it was kind of disappointing. You know, I don't want to give away too much of the plot of what happens, but, you know, when that's lost.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say, because it happens so early, that Anna's father abandons the family.
Yeah.
He disappears. We don't know what's happened to him. We know that he had some involvement with a gangster, because the opening scene, you know, takes place at the gangster's home on Manhattan Beach, where Anna and her father have gone, and then we know that the father disappears, and everyone believes that he has abandoned the family. At a later point, Anna begins to question that. But yes, I mean, I think in some sense, the book is obviously about many things, but one thing it is certainly about is the difficulty between parents and children, the difficulty of letting go of one's child and letting him or her become an independent person.
Mm. I didn't even think about that, but you're right. There's a lot of, not just Eddie and Anna, but there's other father-child relationships that are, some of them more central and some of them kind of peripheral, but there's a lot of them in the book.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I have two kids who are now 16 and 14, and I always wondered whether, you know, motherhood would really enter into my work very much, and I sort of hoped it wouldn't, because that's, you know, again, when I bump up against my own life, I find it difficult, and I think the way I got around that is that I really focused on fathers and daughters.
Mm.
The mother-daughter relationship is not a major part of this book at all. So I find all kinds of, in retrospect, it's clear to me that I find all kinds of tricky ways to conceal from myself the fact that I am in certain ways writing about my own life, but it's so twisted and kind of buried that it's only later that I even know it.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Jennifer Egan, author of Manhattan Beach. Jennifer B., I do want to get more into this story, but I also wanted to ask you, you know, you won a Pulitzer Prize in 2011, I believe. Mm-hmm. And how many books had you published at that point?
Well, that was for my fifth.
That was your fifth. Okay. And now you're on your seventh.
No, this is the sixth.
This is the sixth. Oh, okay. This is the first one.
Long gap.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, was there a lot of pressure on you to match what you had done before?
I didn't feel pressure coming from anyone else. I mean, I felt like my publisher and my agent basically said, you know, keep doing your thing. And doing my thing for me usually means doing something very different from what I had done the last time. I think I did feel pressure from within myself, because I knew that I had found more readers than I had had before, and I was eager to please them.
Mm.
And that did create some pressure when I thought about the fact that this book was going to be so different from Goon Squad. But, you know, I think it was painful, actually. There were a couple of uncomfortable years when I was struggling to find a way. I think my writing procedure, which I've described a little bit, the many handwritten pages, was a strange one to try to use to write a historical novel, because since I start without a plot or characters, I therefore don't really have a story. And so while it was necessary to do a fair amount of research just to get going with this one, because I knew absolutely nothing about any of the worlds that I've described the book as being about, I also, you know, once I started writing, began to have a sense of what the story might be, and that led me into all kinds of situations about which I still knew nothing. So there was a weird feeling of needing to do research in order to write, but not knowing what I needed to research until I was writing. And the result of that was just a feeling of tremendous incompetence for about 2 years. And I think that the pain of that incompetence was probably intensified by the feeling that expectations on me were higher, because I had actually found a broad readership for the first time in my career, really.
And was your publisher sort of impatient to get to capitalize on that?
No, they were really great.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I think they were very understanding. No, I mean, I think they understood, you know, we all wanted the same thing, which was for me to write a decent book. And I think everyone knows that pressuring someone is not the best way to get that result.
True, true. Was it, you know, was winning the Pulitzer like a surprise to you?
Oh my God. It was a tremendous shock. I had never really thought of myself as a person who won things. You know, I don't think I'd ever won a raffle. And so it was really, in a way it sort of involved a realignment of my understanding of my relationship to the world.
Mm.
You know, I just didn't really think of myself as that person who would win things and sort of, you know, be the really lucky one. I had felt up until then that I certainly was rewarded for my hard work. It's not that I thought I had a rough deal, but I didn't feel that my luck exceeded my effort. And with Goon Squad, I feel that it actually did. It was. You know, in some ways it was a really fun book to write. It was much less tortured than some others I've worked on, and yet I felt like the rewards just poured in. And that was really shocking. It's just not what I expected.
What was it about that book that captured the imagination of so many people?
You know, I still don't absolutely know that. I think that I somehow had the good luck to seem to be talking about our present moment in a way that people found interesting. I think one thing was, you know, again, technological. I was writing the book before the iPhone even came out, but in the end, I think felt to people like in some ways I was mimicking or kind of creating the sensation of online experience, the way you can sort of be curious about something and then fall into a whole different page or circumstance in which you're exploring that thing, and then you can get curious about something else and fall into yet another. And some people felt that Goon Squad emulated that kind of experience. I was not thinking about online navigation as I wrote it, but I understand why people say that. And I think the other thing is, in a way, the music industry ended up being something that people may have been interested in or curious about for several reasons. One is that it has had such a difficult time in the last 10 years or so, the industry itself. And right. Also, you know, more and more we live with our own playlists, and, you know, that's just an ongoing feature of the technology that is part of most of our lives now. And I think that has really intensified, at least for myself, my awareness of the relationship between time and music, because I have my own playlist, and it sort of takes me through my own life. So I don't really know. I mean, the answer is I don't know, but I'm sure lucky that for whatever reason, it felt relevant at that moment.
Wow. So let's go back now to your writing process and with Manhattan Beach. So you said you knew kind of pretty early on that you wanted a strong female character, that you wanted this book to at least be partially about female strength.
Yes.
How did Lydia show up?
Lydia was a complete surprise to me. She showed up immediately, or at least the possibility of her. I had done a fair amount of research on the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and I expected to begin the book there. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the first surprise was to find that I was writing about a period, you know, many years before that, when Anna is still a little girl. And so, you know, they make this visit to the gangster, as I mentioned before, and right away there's a question on the table, which is, why didn't Anna's little sister and Anna's mother come along? And as I had my character, as Eddie answered the question that the sister was sick and the mother had stayed home to nurse her, I felt right away that that was a lie, but I didn't know what the truth was. And it was only when I then wrote about them arriving home that I saw that Lydia was disabled very severely, mostly nonverbal and, you know, unable to walk or sit up on her own. I was totally taken aback.
Wow. And, of course, Anna talks about her sister in that first visit, too, and says that she tells the other little girl that her sister is mean because she's so beautiful. I found that striking.
I think you know, there's that sense, and I guess I was picking up on this too as I wrote it, that she and her father are practiced at lying about her sister, and that they, you know, they certainly, whatever it is that is true about her, that's not what they're going to tell. And so they've invented other stories, and it's part of a larger collaboration between Anna and her father that is a lot about lying, or at least not revealing things. He does not tell his wife much about what he's doing, and Anna is his kind of silent partner and witness. And the reason he doesn't really tell his wife is that he hates it. He hates the fact he's a guy who lost his money in the stock market and has had to basically return to the docks, which he hates, and work as a longshoreman. And then when that work dried up, because during the Depression there were virtually no ships going in and out of New York Harbor, he then has to become sort of a lackey for the union, which essentially means delivering and receiving bribes and payoffs. So he loathes it, but he brings Anna with him as a way of making it all just feel more wholesome and more pleasant. And she understands that her job is to, you know, see what's going on, but never repeat it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of collusion between them, which certainly extends, you know, it surrounds his working life, but also the collusion involves not revealing anything about their home life to the people they associate with while he's at work.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Jennifer, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. I'll read right from the. I'm going to read a couple of slimmed down version of the first few pages, which are some of what we've already been talking about.
Great.
They'd driven all the way to Mr. Stiles' house before Anna realized that her father was nervous. First, the ride had distracted her, sailing along Ocean Parkway as if they were headed for Coney Island, although it was 4 days past Christmas and impossibly cold for the beach. Then the house itself, a palace of golden brick, 3 stories high, windows all the way round, a rowdy flapping of green and yellow striped awnings. It was the last house on the street, which dead-ended at the sea. Her father eased the Model J against the curb and turned off the motor. "Toots," he said, "don't squint at Mr. Stiles' house." "Of course I won't squint at his house. You're doing it now." "No," she said, "I'm making my eyes narrow." "That's squinting," he said. "You've just defined it." "Not for me." He turned to her sharply. "Don't squint." That was when she knew. She heard him swallow dryly and felt a chirp of worry in her stomach. She was not used to seeing her father nervous. Distracted, yes. Preoccupied, certainly. "Why doesn't Mr. Stiles like squinting?" she asked. "No one does." "You never told me that before." "Would you like to go home?" "No, thank you. I can take you home." "If I squint?" "If you give me the headache I'm starting to get." "If you take me home," Anna said, "you'll be awfully late." She thought he might slap her. He'd done it once after she'd let fly a string of curses she had heard on the docks, his hand finding her cheek invisibly as a whip. The specter of that slap still haunted Anna, with the odd effect of heightening her boldness in defiance of it. Her father rubbed the middle of his forehead, then looked back at her. His nerves were gone. She had cured them. "Anna," he said, "you know what I need you to do." "Of course." "Be your charming self with Mr. Stiles' children while I speak with Mr. Stiles." "I knew that, Papa." "Of course you did." She left the Model J with eyes wide and watering in the sun. It had been their own automobile until after the stock market crash. Now it belonged to the union, which lent it back for her father to do union business. Anna liked to go with him when she wasn't in school, to racetracks, communion breakfasts, and church events, office buildings where elevators lofted them to high floors, occasionally even a restaurant, but never before to a private home like this. The door pull was answered by Mrs. Stiles, who had a movie star's sculpted eyebrows and a long mouth painted glossy red. Accustomed to judging her own mother prettier than every woman she encountered, Anna was disarmed by the evident glamour of Mrs. Stiles. "I was hoping to meet Mrs. Kerrigan," Mrs. Stiles said in a husky voice, holding Anna's father's hand in both of hers, to which he replied that his younger daughter had taken sick that morning and his wife had stayed at home to nurse her. There was no sign of Mr. Stiles. Politely, but she hoped, without visible awe, Anna accepted a glass of lemonade from a silver tray carried by a Negro maid in a pale blue uniform. In the high polish of the entrance hall's wood floor, she caught the reflection of her own red dress, sewn by her mother. Beyond the windows of an adjacent front room, the sea tingled under a thin winter sun. Mr. Stiles' daughter, Tabitha, was only 8, 3 years younger than Anna. Still, Anna allowed the littler girl to tow her by the hand to a downstairs nursery, a room dedicated purely to playing, filled with a shocking array of toys. A quick survey discovered a flossy flirt doll, several large teddy bears, and a rocking horse. There was a nurse in the nursery, a freckled, raspy-voiced woman whose woolen dress strained like an overstacked bookshelf to repress her massive bust. Anna guessed from the broad lay of her face and the merry switch of her eyes that nurse was Irish and felt a danger of being seen through. she resolved to keep her distance. Tabitha cradled her new Christmas doll, a Shirley Temple in a fox fur coat. She watched, entranced, as Anna built her brother's train tracks. "Where do you live?" she asked. "Not far." "By the beach?" "Near it." "May I come to your house?" "Of course," Anna said, fastening tracks as fast as the boys handed them to her. A figure eight was nearly complete. "Have you any brothers?" Tabitha asked. "A sister," Anna said. "She's eight, like you, but she's mean because of being so pretty." Tabitha looked alarmed. "How pretty?" "Extremely pretty," Anna said gravely, then added, "She looks like our mother, who danced with the Follies." The error of this boast accosted her a moment later. "Never part with a fact unless you've no choice," her father's voice in her ears. After lunch, as a reward for their fine behavior, Nurse allowed them to bundle into coats and hats and bolt from a back door along a path that ran behind Mr. Stiles' house to a private beach, a long arc of snow-dusted sand tilted down to the sea. Anna had been to the docks in winter many times, but never to a beach. Miniature waves shrugged up under skins of ice that crackled when she stomped them. Seagulls screamed and dove in the riotous wind, their bellies stark white. The twins had brought along Buck Rogers' ray guns, but the wind turned their shots and death throes into pantomime. Anna watched the sea. There was a feeling she had, standing at its edge, an electric mix of attraction and dread. What would be exposed if all that water should suddenly vanish? A landscape of lost objects, sunken ships, hidden treasure, gold and gems, and the charm bracelet that had fallen from her wrist into a storm drain. Dead bodies, her father always added with a laugh. To him, the ocean was a wasteland. Can I stop there?
That's great. And that was Jennifer Egan reading from Manhattan Beach, the opening of Manhattan Beach. One thing that struck me as you're reading that part and thinking forward, the ocean itself is an important part of this book, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, it's, I felt like in a way I was just trying to get at the ocean from every possible angle, from underneath, from out in the middle of it, from the edge of it. And one thing about the ocean is that it's sort of literal and metaphorical at the same time, which is always sort of an interesting thing. You know, so much of our language involves water metaphors, the ocean is really sort of, I mean, at least to my eye, signifies eternity, the immutability of the earth, and it's also just a very practical place, especially at the time I'm writing about, that people use for all kinds of things. So this was my chance to really get in there and kind of look at the sea from every side.
Now, do you live in New York?
I do. I live in Brooklyn.
You live in Brooklyn. And have you lived near the sea your whole life? Or is that part of, I know that people who grow up going to the beach, you know, have an attachment to it that us Midwesterners don't.
It's not so much going to the beach, but I'm from Chicago originally, where Lake Michigan, which is like an ocean,
right,
really dominates the city. And then I grew up in San Francisco, which, of course, is by the sea. It's surrounded on three sides by water. And because there's so many hills in San Francisco, there's a lot of elevation, and one is really constantly aware of the water. So I think I've grown up with a sense of a large body of water always very near me. And for me, looking at the sea has always been sort of like looking at the stars is for some people. I find it mesmerizing and so stunning to think about the enormity of it, the depth of it, the fact that it touches, every continent, the fact that all of life emerged from it. I find it a very evocative and rich source of meditation, I guess.
And thus the quote at the beginning of your book?
Well, yes. I mean, the quote is from Melville, right. And I came to him via many routes. I mean, for one thing, he wrote, I think, what may be probably the best American novel, Moby Dick, which is an absolute masterpiece, and also a sea story, and Melville was a New Yorker and also a mariner. So he, you know, his book is, it's funny, when I read Moby Dick the first time, I didn't live in New York, so all of that meant very little to me. But, you know, he's basically talking about the attraction of the water, and he's describing how, you know, all over Manhattan, people are always rushing to the edges to look at the water. And so for a New Yorker, it's just a lot of fun to revisit that material.
Mm. Now, Melville wrote in the 1800s?
Late 19th century.
And I, when I was coming back from this family trip to Rome, and I picked up New York Times in the airport lounge, and this past weekend, and there was you. There you were, talking about books that you like to read. And you talked about 19th century writers as a really strong influence on you.
Very much so. And actually, I need to correct myself because Moby Dick was published in 1851.
Okay.
So roughly contemporaneously with a lot of the writers that I have been reading a lot lately and really do admire, many of whom are British. So I'm thinking of people like George Eliot and Trollope, Dickens, I love 19th century novels. I think part of what I love about them is that they're very complex. They are often big, capacious books and really page turners. I mean, a lot of these books were written in serialized form, and so they had a lot in common with serialized TV of today. You know, they tend to have a cliffhanger quality because they're trying to make sure people come back for the next installment. They tend to follow lots of different characters through their worlds, which is something that I love about serialized TV. And often, you know, there's this funny, not tension exactly, but a sort of gap sometimes between the particular stakes or mystery or, you know, question of an episode versus the entire arc of the season. Mm. Sometimes you almost lose touch with the bigger story because the immediate questions are so arresting. So I love that too. So there are just a lot of things that I admire about 19th century fiction. It's just a lot of fun to immerse myself in it.
And do you feel that those aspects of it that you really like showed up somewhat in this book?
That's not for me to judge, probably. I would be happy if people felt that they did. But, you know, I was thinking just as much about those kinds of books when I was writing A Visit from the Goon Squad, which is written in parts, and each part is about a different character. So this, you know, it's not just this book where I hope to, you know, bring to bear some of the fun aspects of 19th century fiction. I hope to do that in all of my books. And this one has one big difference from Goon Squad, though, which is that in A Visit from the Goon Squad, which is much more about contemporary life, a lot of the big action is off stage, and we instead tend to read about people dealing with the consequences of some of that action. In Manhattan Beach, I really wanted to write an adventure story. I felt like I was thinking about books like Treasure Island and Mutiny on the Bounty and, you know, old, kind of, in a way, sort of old-fashioned in the sense that big, crazy events happen and I write about them right on the page. So we have shipwreck, sea survival, you know, gangland murder, just kind of big, broad, hopefully exciting events that were just incredibly fun to write about.
Now, in all those cases, I expect you had to do a lot of research to write about them authentically.
Very much so. Absolutely, yes. I mean, research isn't everything, that's for sure. In the end, you've got to animate it with people. And what I found was that I needed to get to a point where I knew what I was talking about to such a degree that I could start taking liberties and having fun.
Mm.
All I was doing was showing that I knew how it worked. That's actually very boring and sort of inanimate. So I had to find ways to get past the research and just be able to do what I do. But that took a lot of research, actually, to get to that point. Yes, there. And what I learned is that writing about the past is not just about writing about the past, because what everyone brings to the moment that they live in is their own pasts. So if the present moment that I'm writing about is the 30s and then later the 40s, to really write persuasively and to imagine my way inside people of those times, I had to know what their pasts consisted of. What are they remembering? What are they wishing they could return to or glad that they overcame? So it's not as simple as knowing what kind of pens people used and, you know, what was in the newspaper that morning. That's nothing. I mean, you can figure that out on Google in 20 minutes. What the real challenge is having a sense of what the collective memories of that time consisted of for people of different ages. And therefore what they would have brought to that moment of their lives.
Mm. So for that, did you like look for diaries and memoirs that were written of that time period?
Very much so. I mean, my research fell into several categories, and I utilized my experience as a journalist a great deal in trying to pursue these matters from all kinds of angles. one area was just plain old, you know, library research, finding out-of-print books, lots of technical manuals, really understanding the nuts and bolts of things like shipbuilding, you know, officers' duties in the merchant marine, you know, protocol in abandoning ship, that sort of thing. But then another layer was finding people who had a lot of these events still in their memories, you know, folks who, and I started, luckily, doing this research in about 2005, talking to people already in their 80s by then. So many of them have passed on. Some have not, and, you know, they're still, you know, full of these amazing memories, and I hope I can be so lucky. But talking with living people from various realms, ranging from people who grew up in New York and could speak to the New York of their childhoods, merchant mariners who sailed during the war, who were incredibly helpful to me, and then women who worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I was involved in an oral history project in which we interviewed many of these ladies who gave me lots of amazing details, some of which I used pretty directly in my story. And then there was a category that you kind of allude to with diaries, which is, you know, fresh encounters with human beings who, in fact, are no longer living. And I would put in that category diaries, letters, and also oral history recordings. Not necessarily audio, but there was a book called You Must Remember This, which is oral history of New York, all of the boroughs of New York, from 1890 until World War II. And that was an incredible help to me. You know, hearing people talk in their own voices about their neighborhoods, their childhoods, you know, what the New York that they remembered at various points, incredibly helpful.
Wow. So how do you decide, like, you said you mentioned you did research, you start, and then you wrote, but as you're writing, you found out what else you needed to research. Would you go back and forth, or did you write that whole 1,400 pages and then go back and do the research that you needed to do?
I never stopped researching. I was always doing both. Sometimes I was researching stuff that I needed to know right then, but sometimes I was writing and also researching things I knew I would need to know. And not only was the research continuous, but it was actually a real solace as I struggled for a couple of years with feeling that the book really might not work out, because the research always was such a joyful experience, and it always felt so relevant that it gave me a lot of hope that there must be some point to all of it. Like, why did I want to read something, a manual called How to Abandon Ship? And why did I find that so fascinating that I could read it on the elliptical machine at the gym, you know, garnering some odd looks from
I bet.
Around me. You know, that it felt urgently important to me, that information, and I kept thinking, you know, it is interesting to know how to abandon a ship, but truly, I don't know if I'm going to be able to use this in my life. I hope not. There's got to be some other reason that this feels so necessary. And so that was also very reassuring. The research was just an absolute delight, and I will be enriched by it for the rest of my life. And I would have been even if the book didn't work out at all.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Jennifer Egan, author of Manhattan Beach. With all that research, do you think you'll set any other books in this time period?
I don't think so. I wish I could say the opposite. However, I will admit I'm very intrigued by 19th century New York. So I may just keep going back. But I really am interested in the 19th century. I'm interested in the time when New York really became the city that it still is to a large degree, although a lot of the 19th century structures are being torn down for more modern buildings. But New York really is, you know, architecturally still a very 19th century city. And so I'm interested in when it became that. I don't think that'll be my next project, but it would be really fun to do that down the line. And I also feel like, in a way, I've sort of taught myself a bit about how to approach a novel set outside my lifetime, or at least maybe I'll have a little more confidence, and the anxiety won't be quite so great as it was with this one. But there's nothing like the escape of working on a book set outside of my lifetime. It was like time travel at a certain point. It felt like flying. It was so delightful to do it once I got over the feeling that it was just all going to be a disaster.
Well, I love reading historical fiction, and that's probably why it is like time travel. You get to live in a different time for those hours that you're inside the book.
Exactly. I mean, that's why I, you know, again, back to my obsession with the 19th century novel. I mean, you know, I'm surprised that more people are not reading those books, because talk about time travel. I mean, you don't even have to have someone pretend that they're back in that time. You're actually, you know, inside the mind of someone writing about their world 150 years ago. It's really a thrill.
Oh, yeah. Now, was Manhattan Beach your first historical novel then?
It depends how you define that. I mean, The Invisible Circus, my first novel, is certainly involved research about matters that were unfolding when I was just a little girl, and therefore, you know, really not part of my experience. I was really interested in how youth movements, you know, pacifist youth movements, turned violent here and in Europe. And I did a fair amount of research, especially about the Red Army faction in Germany. And of course, that was, you know, that book was published in 1995, so this was basically pre-internet, or at least pre-internet for me.
Right.
So I was, you know, just sitting in the library doing it all there. So it's not completely unknown to me to try to link up with historical facts in my work, but this was of an entirely different order. I mean, because not only was the entire period outside of my lifetime, but the amount of technical knowledge and real workplace experience that I depict, you know, people are at work a lot in this book, and that is you have to really know what you're doing to talk about someone doing their job, because people who do their jobs tend to know those jobs well and do them almost as second nature. So to really portray that persuasively, one has to know a great deal.
Right. And it's, if you go to and ask somebody even how they do it, they're not going to remember what it is that people who've never done it before don't know. So you really have dig in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, speaking of jobs, is writing your full-time job?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I also am a journalist, and that is a very different kind of writing, although wonderfully symbiotic for me with fiction writing. I think I mentioned before that I don't know if I would have known how to approach this quantity of research if I didn't have some experience as a journalist. I think I would have just been too overwhelmed by the project. So I do like to write long research pieces that take place over time, often involving very, you know, complex, sometimes medically oriented issues. I'm working on one now about babies born with opioid dependence. So yes, I would say between those two things, I do teach on and off, but not. I don't have sort of a regular teaching job. But yes, I've been very lucky and able to write as my job for some years now.
And at what point in your life did you know, this is it, I'm going to be a writer?
I knew that at a pretty specific point in my life. I took a gap year between high school and college. I just was desperate to, you know, having grown up in California, I had never been to Europe. It's much, you know, it's just a long way away. And I just wanted to see something of the world before I went to college. So I did various things. At that point, I really thought I wanted to be an archaeologist. And in fact, I had applied to the University of Pennsylvania in their anthropology department and had been accepted and was, you know, quite sure that's what I was going to be doing with my life. But the first thing I did on my gap year was paid to go on a small archaeological dig in Campsville, Illinois. And what I found was that I actually didn't really like it. I had envisioned, you know, using a big shovel and unearthing, you know, beautiful urns and sort of dusting them off and putting them on a shelf. And, of course, that had nothing to do with what archaeology was. Everything existed in the form of shards, and you had to lower the earth very gradually with a scalpel rather than trying to dig anything out of it. So there were various misconceptions I had that were cleared up abruptly during my short dig in the 99-degree heat of Campsville, Illinois, on
Whoa.
One square meter of earth. And so, in a way, the gap year did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was rid me of a career goal that, in fact, was not really the right choice for me. So anyway, I did this and that to earn money and ended up finally getting a backpack in the spring of that year and taking a Freddie Laker Airlines, long defunct, from San Francisco to London and traveling around on my own. And it was thrilling, but also very nerve-wracking. I mean, this was a time when, obviously, there were no cell phones, no internet, and I felt tremendously cut off from my home, which was separated from me by a 9-hour time difference. And I think in that very isolated state, I felt extremely anxious, and somehow out of that anxiety came the recognition that of the fact that writing for me was just a deep part of my relationship to the world, and that I needed to honor that by making it my vocation. It really, you know, I wrote years later about Catholic seminarians, and one of the things I was always curious about was how they knew they wanted to be priests, and they would all of them described as sort of awakening to a vocation, and I feel like I really had that too. It was not that I thought I would be so good at it. It was that I just knew I had to do it.
You know, it's interesting you mention Catholic seminarians, because that's what our family trip to Rome was, to see my nephew be ordained in St. Peter's.
What a place to be ordained.
Yeah,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, he was ordained as a transitional deacon. He'll be ordained as a priest next year. And he's going to seminary in Rome. He's been there for 3 years. So, yeah, that's pretty amazing. And before that, my daughter and I traveled around a little bit. Before that, we were in Austria and Germany. And my first trip to Europe was in 1976, right after high school. And then I didn't go again until 2003. And even between 2003 and now, it is so much easier because of ATMs, cell phones, Wi-Fi.
Exactly. Do you remember all the traveler's checks?
Yes, I do.
Traveler's checks, calling centers. I mean, when I first told my children that when you made a phone call, either the phone rang and rang and rang, or someone answered, or you got a busy signal, my younger son said, "Did you have electricity?"
Well, yeah, I forgot even about answering machines. We didn't have answering machines. We didn't have email. We didn't have suitcases with wheels.
I know. So, you know, this that we, of course, now sound like dinosaurs having this conversation. It wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't.
From a telecommunications standpoint, anyway, and perhaps a luggage transport standpoint, it was a really different time. And so I think about that a lot because I think about, again, back to discovering that I wanted to be a writer, which grew out of a sense of tremendous solitude. I don't know if people experience solitude like that anymore. I know I don't. And in a way, I'm thrilled. Like, if my kids go to Europe, I will be all over them. I'm going to want to know every day what they're doing.
Right, they're going to post pictures on Facebook.
I would have loved to be in touch with my family that way, but I sometimes wonder if I would have realized that I wanted to be a writer. I don't know.
That's a very good point. I mean, when I was there for a month when I was 17. I got one letter from home. Period. That was it.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I remember going to the American Express centers to get mail. I mean, it really was in these ways. In some ways, life was no different at all. But in these ways, one realizes that a certain revolution actually has occurred. I mean, it's a little like talking about life before cars.
Yeah, which fortunately I don't remember.
Yeah, and I think, like all inventions of that sort, it's an open question whether, you know, how much they've helped and how much they've hurt. I mean, I think everything brings advantages and disadvantages, and this stuff is no exception.
It's true, but it's hard to imagine going back, isn't it?
Impossible.
Well, Jennifer, we're out of time, and I just want to thank you so much for being with us today. Manhattan Beach, Jennifer Egan, just an incredibly good story. And I've already got people lined up to borrow the book from me when I'm done with it.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
It was all my pleasure. So if you are listening to us on Friday afternoon, keep in mind that this show will be rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. And stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile. And we usually close with a quote from my mother, who's not here, so I'm going to read the quote that Jennifer has at the front of Manhattan Beach from Herman Melville. "Yes, as everyone knows, meditation and water are wedded forever." And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.